The House with the Clock in Its Walls, Chapter 1. Louis Barnevelt fidgeted and wiped his sweaty palms on the seat of the bus that was roaring toward New Zebedee. The year was 1948, and it was a warm, windy summer evening. Outside, that is. Louis could see the moonlit trees tossing gently beyond his window, which was sealed shut like all the windows on the bus. He looked down at his purple corduroy trousers, the kind that go whip-whip when you walk. He put his hand up and rubbed it across his hair, which was parted in the middle and slicked down with wild root cream oil. His hand was greasy now, so he wiped it on the seat again. His lips were moving, and he was saying a prayer. It was one of his altar boy prayers. Qui es tu es Deus fortitido mea quare me repulsisti, et quare tristis incido dum affigit me incumbens? For thou, O God, art my strength. Why have you cast me off, and why do I go sorrowful while the enemy afflicts me? He tried to remember more prayers, but the only one he could come up with was another question. Quare tristis est anima mea, est quare conturbas me? Why art thou sorrowful, O my soul, and why do you trouble me? It seemed to Louis that all he could think of these days were questions. Where am I going? Who will I meet? Will I like them? What will happen to me? Louis Barnevelt was 10 years old. Until recently, he had lived with his parents in a small town near Milwaukee. But his father and mother had been killed suddenly one night in an auto accident, and now Louis was on his way to New Zebedee, the county seat of Farnham County in the state of Michigan. He was going to live with his Uncle Jonathan, who he had never met in his life. Of course, Louis had heard a few things about Uncle Jonathan, like that he smoked and drank and played poker. These were not such bad things in a Catholic family, but Louis had two maiden aunts who were Baptists, and they had warned him about Jonathan. He hoped that the warnings would turn out to be unnecessary. As the bus rounded a curve, Louis looked at his reflection in the window next to his seat. He saw a moody, fat face with shiny cheeks. The lips on the face were moving. Louis was saying the altar boy prayers again, this time with the wish that they might make Uncle Johnson like him. Judica me Deus. Judge me, O God. No, don't judge me. Help me to live a happy life. It was 9:05 when the bus pulled up in front of Heemsmuth's Rexall drugstore in the town of New Zebedee. Louis got up, wiped his hands on his trousers, and tugged at the enormous cardboard suitcase that hung out over the edge of the metal rack. Louis's father had bought the suitcase in London at the end of World War II. It was covered with ripped and faded Cunard Line stickers. Louis pulled hard, and the suitcase lurched down onto his head. He staggered back across the aisle with the suitcase, held perilously in the air, then he sat down suddenly, and the suitcase landed in his lap with a whoop. Oh, come on, don't kill yourself before I have a chance to meet you. There in the aisle stood a man with a bushy red beard that was streaked in several places with white. His Big Mac khaki trousers were bulged out in front by his pot belly, and he was wearing a gold button red vest over a blue work shirt. Louis noticed that the vest had four pockets. There were pipe cleaners sticking out of the top, too, and a chain of paper clips was strung between the lower pair. One end of the chain was hooked to the winding knob of a gold watch. Jonathan Van Olden Barnevelt took his steaming pipe out of his mouth and held out his hand. Hi, Louis. I'm your Uncle Jonathan. I recognize you from a picture your father once sent me. Welcome to New Zebedee. Jonathan shook hands and noticed that the back of Jonathan's hand was covered with a springy mat of red hair. The coat of hair ran right up his sleeve and disappeared. Louis wondered if he had red hair all over his body. Jonathan hefted the suitcase and started down the steps of the bus. Good Lord, what a monster. It ought to have wheels on the bottom. Ugh, did you pack some bricks from your house? Louis looked so sad at the mention of his house that Jonathan decided to change the subject. He cleared his throat and said, well now, as I was saying, welcome to Farnham County and the beautiful historic New Zebedee. Population 6,000, not counting. A bell overhead began to strike the hour. Jonathan stopped talking. He froze on the spot. He dropped the suitcase and his arms hung limp at his side. Louis, frightened, looked up at him. Jonathan's eyes were blazed. The bell continued to toll. Louis looked up. The sound was coming from a tall brick steeple across the street. The arches of the belfry made a howling mouth and two gaping eyes. Below the mouth was a large glowing clock face with iron numerals. Clang! Another stroke. It was a deep-throated iron bell, and its sound made Louis feel hopeless and helpless. Bells like that always did. But what was wrong with Uncle Jonathan? The tolling stopped. Jonathan broke out of his trance. He shook his head convulsively with a jerky motion, raised his hand to his face. He was sweating profusely now. He mopped his forehead and his streaming cheeks. Sorry, Louis. I just remembered that I had left the kettle boiling on the stove. I always fade out like that when I remember something I've forgotten, or vice versa. Oh, no, the pot's probably ruined by now. Come on, let's get moving. Louis looked hard at his uncle, but he said nothing. Together, the two of them started to walk. They left the briskly lit Main Street, and before long, they were trotting briskly down the long, tree-lined avenue called Mansion Street. The overhanging boughs made Mansion Street into a long, rustling tunnel. Pools of lamplight stretched off into the distance. As they walked, Jonathan asked Louis how his schoolwork was coming, and whether or not he knew what George Kell's batting average was this year. He told him he'd have to become a Tiger fan now that he lived in Michigan. Jonathan did not complain any more about the suitcase, but he did stop frequently to set it down and flex his reddened hands. It seemed to Louis that Jonathan talked more loudly in the darkness between the streetlights, though why he did this, Louis couldn't say. Grown-ups were not supposed to be afraid of the dark, and anyway, this was not a dark, lonely street. There were lights on in most of the houses, and Louis could hear people laughing and talking and slamming doors. His uncle was certainly a strange person, but he was strange in a likable way. At the corner of Mansion and High, Johnson stopped. He set down the suitcase in front of a mailbox that said, "For deposit of mail only." "I live at the top of the hill," said Jonathan, pointing up. High Street was well named. Up they went, leaning forward and plodding slowly. Louis asked Jonathan several times if he could carry the suitcase, but each time Jonathan said, "No thanks, he could manage it." Louis began to be sorry that he had packed all those books and lead soldiers. When they got to the top of the hill, Jonathan set down the suitcase. He took out a red bandana handkerchief and mopped his face with it. "Well, there it is, Louis. Barneveld's Folly. What do you think of it?" Louis looked. He saw a three-story stone mansion with a tall turret on the front. The whole house was lit up, downstairs, upstairs, and upper stairs. There was even a light in the little oval window that was set like an eye in a bank of shingles at the top of a turret. In the front of the yard grew a large chestnut tree. Its leaves rustled in the warm summer breeze. Jonathan was standing at a parade rest, his hands behind him, his legs wide apart. Again, he said, "What do you think of it, Louis, huh?" "I love it, Uncle Jonathan. I've always wanted to live in a mansion, and this is sure some mansion." Louis walked up to the frilly fence and touched one of the pom-poms that ran in a row along the top. He stared at the sign that spelled out 100 in red glass reflectors. "Is it real, Uncle Jonathan? The house, I mean?" Jonathan glanced at him strangely. "Yes, yes, yes, of course it's real. It's real. Let's go inside." Jonathan lifted the loop of a shoestring that held the gate shut. The gate squeaked open, and Louis started up the walk. Jonathan followed close behind, lugging the suitcase. Up the front steps they went. The front hall was dark, but there was a light at the far end of it. Jonathan set down the suitcase and put his arm around Louis. "Come on, let's go in. Don't be bashful. It's your house now." Louis walked down the long hall. It seemed to take forever. At the other end, he emerged into a room full of yellow light. There were pictures in heavy gilt frames on the walls. There was a mantelpiece covered with a wild assortment of junk, and there was a big round table in the middle of the room. And over in the corner was a gray-haired woman in a baggy purple dress. She was standing with her ear to the wall listening. Louis stopped and stared. He felt embarrassed. It was as if he had walked in on someone who was doing something he shouldn't be doing. He thought that he and Jonathan had made a good deal of noise coming in, but it was very apparent that the lady, whoever she was, had been surprised when he entered the room. Surprised and embarrassed, like himself. Now, she straightened up, smoothed her dress, and said cheerfully, "Hi there, I'm Mrs. Zimmerman. I live next door." Louis found himself staring into one of the wrinkliest faces he'd ever seen. The eyes were friendly, and all the wrinkles were drawn up into smile lines. He shook hands. "This is Louis Florence," said Jonathan. "You remember Charlie writing about him? The bus was on time for a change. They must have gotten the driver drunk. Hey, have you been stealing any of my coins?" Jonathan walked over to the table. Now Louis noticed that the red checkered tablecloth was covered with heaps and stacks of coins, all kinds of coins, most of them foreign. Donut-shaped Arabian coins with Boy Scout knots all over them, a heap of dark brown copper coins, all of which were stamped with a picture of a bald man who wore a handlebar mustache. There were big, heavy English pennies that showed Queen Victoria in various states of chinniness, and there were tiny silver coins no thicker than your fingernail. There was an egg-shaped Mexican silver dollar and a genuine Roman coin covered with green rust. But most of all, in shiny golden stacks were brass coins with Bon Pour Un Franc printed on them. Louis liked the phrase, and since he didn't know any French, he got it twisted around in his mind until it came out, "Bon sour 1 franc." "No, I've not been stealing any of your precious brush or doubloons," said Mrs. Zimmerman in an irritated voice. "I was just straightening up the stack. Okay, brush more."